Hello, everybody. Welcome to the first podcast in the Holocaust History Podcast series. Today's discussion, I had a really, really great conversation with Omer Bartov, who is a great Holocaust scholar, about a topic that's actually kind of interesting because we talked a lot about writing fiction instead of writing nonfiction, as most Holocaust scholars do. It's a really, really neat conversation about his new book, The Butterfly and the Axe, but also about, you know, what we might be able to get in terms of truth from fiction that we might not be able to get from sort of conventional, I'm using scare quotes here, factual history. So really, really interesting conversation. I think you're going to really enjoy listening to it and thinking about the ways in which we remember and forget the past. And then we do end up talking a little bit about current events and about the ways in which Holocaust memory and rhetoric is being used in the context of the current Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So really a lot to think about. And yeah, let's get into it. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first episode of the Holocaust History Podcast. I'm your host, Waitman Bourne. And tonight, we're really, really fortunate to have with us Omer Bartov. Omer Bartov is the Samuel Pisar Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Brown University. He's the author of a number of really, really important and award-winning books on the Holocaust on a variety of topics, from the German Army, which is something that I found particularly useful when I was writing my first book, to interethnic relations in Eastern Europe and border regions, which I think will be of particular significance here. In addition, relevant to the book we're going to talk about today, which is called The Butterfly and the Axe, is his book, Anatomy of a Genocide, The Life and Death of a Town Called Buchach, which is also about his family's hometown. It's a microhistory of his family's hometown in Ukraine. And probably, you know, if we were to sort of assign a companion book, might be an interesting thing to have. So, Omer, welcome. Thank you so much for coming. And I wonder if you might just start by telling us a little bit about how you got into this particular field of studies.
Well, hi, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be the first person on your podcast. So how did I get into this? It's a kind of a long story, but I'll try to make it short. I grew up in Israel. I was surrounded by people who either escaped from the Holocaust or survived the Holocaust or had families killed in the Holocaust. And so the Holocaust was all around me, but people didn't speak about it the way we do. It was a very personal thing. And as I was growing up, my sense was that it was not something that one could study because it was a very intimate experience that people had. And so my own interest was actually in military history. And that led me to study the German army. And studying the German army, I started realizing that the German army had been actually involved in massive crimes, especially on the Eastern Front. And so my first challenge was to actually try and confront the myth at the time that the German army had nothing to do with those crimes. It was all the bad people in the back, the black shirts, the brown shirts, all those others. But the German army was fighting for Germany and to protect Germany from Bolshevism. And it was only after I left Israel in 1979 and came to the United States and had some distance from the kind of place where I grew up and the sense that the Holocaust was both everywhere and everybody had an opinion about it and could not be an academic topic. that I realized that I had been reading about it for many years. I was asked to write some article, a review article, so I read many books for that article, and then I realized, yes, this is something that I've actually been preparing myself to study. And so that is how I really got to study it. I should add that I had a period in which I realized that many people were studying the Holocaust at the time, were studying the Final Solution as something that had been done by the Germans, and that one had to figure out. And therefore, much of the history was a history of perpetrators and perpetrator decisions and decision-making. And I increasingly felt that it left the main thing out. Maybe the people that I left behind in Israel, that is, those who were the victims of that. So it was not a history of genocide, of what genocide does, but how genocide is organized. And that led me really to try and look at it from a very different angle, which brought me eventually, years later, to writing Anatomy of a Genocide, which is really a history from below, if you like, or a local history of what happens in one town when there's a genocide there.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I that book also, I think, is a really important one, right? And one of the things I have to, you know, my bias is here as well, is in some ways towards microhistory. Because I think, and I think as you point out in that book as well, that ultimately it's individuals, it's people, right, that are doing these things. And obviously ideology is important, obviously history is important. But you can really start to see the decisions that are being made when you look at where the rubber meets the road, as it were, if that makes sense. You know, it sort of seems to me like that's where we see the truth, if you were. And we'll talk about truth, I suppose, in a minute. Can you tell us about, so the book that we're talking about for the listeners is called The Butterfly and the Axe. And it's a different kind of book, particularly for a Holocaust historian or for an historian in general to write. So I'm going to let Omer introduce it and tell us about this book. Cause I think it's something that you might not, that our listeners and readers might not expect.
Right. So The Butterfly and the Axe is a book that you could define as trying to fill in the gaps that history leaves out. So it is about history, but I think its basic assumption is, and I made that assumption because I'm a historian and because, in fact, I wrote a book that tried to get to the people who both carry out genocide and those upon whom it is perpetrated, that much of what genocide is about people disappearing, people having no life, people having no record. We don't know who they were. We don't know how they lived. We don't know how they were murdered. We don't know where they're buried. We know nothing. They disappear. And so when I was researching and then writing Anatomy of a Genocide, which is about my mother's hometown, in the back of my mind, this was not a book about my family, but in the back of my mind, I sort of wondered, I mean, am I going to find out anything about my own family? And I didn't look for it, but I thought it would be interesting if I did. And I found nothing. So my family disappeared completely from the historical record. All I knew was some rumors, some gossip, and there was no way to establish whether it was true or not. And it occurred to me that this, of course, is not only about my family. It happened, as I say, in millions of cases, in all genocides, because the people who are killed don't have time to write a record of what happened to them. They're just sort of swept into oblivion. They're sucked into a black hole. And so I thought that I wanted to try and write a book that is, in some ways, against history. That is, that it would tell the story of a particular family. And it's based on some things that I know about my own family, some rumors, some stories, as if there were documents. So, but I would have to invent them because they don't exist. And I would give them a life of their own through this virtual history. And when I started doing that, I realized that it was not only a book that tries to save from oblivion people who had been sucked into this black hole, but also a book about the generations that followed, two generations that followed thereafter, who, without knowing what happened to their family, know that something happened, know that something terrible, atrocious, murderous had happened. And that knowledge, and the people who know a little bit, and people have all kinds of suspicions, that knowledge, that horror, tends to transition from one generation to another and has a warping effect on people. It somehow distorts who they are because there is this secret of a murder that happened. And that eventually the only way to try and overcome that and stop this transition from one generation to the next is to go back to the scene of the murder. And I do that through two main characters. There is a sort of unnamed character who is telling the story and who's trying to do some research on it. But the two main characters are an Israeli woman and a British-Ukrainian man who end up in a town that you know, in Lviv. And they're both trying to find out something about their own family, something that goes back two generations. And it turns out that they're traced back to the same village and to the same event that really determined their own lives. And through that confrontation, they, in a sense, open up. They give a kind of window of hope for themselves and for some kind of reconciliation between these obviously competing memories and legacies.
Yeah, thanks. And I want to make sure that we don't give any spoilers, I suppose. Though obviously this is a story about the Holocaust, and so we sort of have some understanding of what might happen in it. I think it's interesting, by the way, just that you don't think that the historical narrator was the main character. I kind of felt like he was, in the sense that, you know, he's the vehicle through which we're learning all of this, and we're in some ways. I felt like when I was reading it, I felt like I was, it was interesting because you would say something like, you know, in the narrator's voice, you know, I had a busy semester and I had to wait to, you know, which makes perfect sense. Right. And I'm imagining you saying this, but I'm thinking as I'm sitting there reading this, I'm like, no, like stop and translate this particular document. I want to know what's going on. So I think it's interesting that you would say he's actually not the main character and I guess you're in some ways he does seem to be, the one that isn't confronting his past as directly as the other two? Is that?
Yes, you know, so I'll say two things here. I think one is that the unnamed historian who is sort of putting this together, who is speaking with people, who is finding some documents and so forth, has a certain detachment from the events, and in a way, a certain detachment even from the people who are around him and perhaps from himself. So he's, in some ways, he himself has maybe became paralyzed by it, maybe became inured to it, but he maintains this detachment, as Tali, the Israeli woman, says to him. You know, he says, I just want facts. I don't need anything else. I just want facts. But of course, all these facts in the book are invented. And so he's looking for facts. He's finding facts, but these facts are fiction. And the second thing is that I wanted to write this book or this story for a long time, but I couldn't quite find the voice for writing it. And I couldn't write it the way a conventional novel is written. And so a few years ago, I was teaching a class on European history, and I had my students read excerpts from Sebald, from the German author Sebald, who's a fantastic writer. His most famous book is Austerlitz. And Sebald uses a particular technique. And as I was reading it, it suddenly hit me that this was the kind of voice that I need. And the technique is that you don't tell the story, and often the person you're speaking with also does not tell the story, but a story is being told, and it's being told to you, and it may be told to you by someone who's telling you what they heard from a third person. So there is a detachment in that sense, which is not an emotional detachment, but it's a detachment that, to me, felt much more authentic. In some ways, it's the way we work as historians, because we're not there. We are there through somebody else's voice, document, photograph, testimony, and we have to imagine ourselves into that place if we are to understand it, right? And so, in that sense, the author or the narrator in The Butterfly and the Axe has these two layers of detachment. One is his own, and the other is how he gets to what happened or what might have happened, because we never know for sure if what they find out happened actually happened. And that is the way we end up also as historians, and that's the way we end up in any story we hear, even if we hear a family story by our grandfather. I mean, how are we to know? And so in that sense, to me, it felt much more authentic, much more real to make that fiction into history by maintaining these sort of layers of distance.
Yeah, I had that same feeling. I actually wrote that down as one of my things to think about. Is that almost the entire book could be in quotation marks, right? Because it's an oral history in a certain sense, right? I mean, like everyone is, everything is epistolary in the sense that, you know, it's either someone telling someone something in an oral or email kind of format, or it's someone writing a document like in the end, a confession, you know, which is directed at someone else. So in that sense, it is very sort of historical, in the sense that there's very little. I mean, it'd be interesting that there's very little sort of third person narrative, or I guess second first person narrative of I did this, I did that. It's very much a discussion that leads you to kind of have to piece the pieces together, even when as an historian, you know where the gaps are. In the sense of when we're trying to know a story, and even as you were inventing the evidence, one of the things I think is so powerful about the book is you also were able to invent the ambiguities. To put in the things that aren't clear, rather than telling us the whole story in sort of a neat kind of Dan Brown, Da Vinci Code kind of way where everything fits together. And maybe it's because I'm an historian as well, but that really seemed to resonate with me, in the sense that, you know, I have here, and then when I first started reading the book, cause I didn't really know what to expect. And I felt for like the first half of the book, I felt this intense foreboding, because I mean, you know, this is what we do, and I knew something awful was going to happen, and I'm kind of just waiting for the other shoe to drop, and then eventually it does, and I felt a weird sort of relief that, well, now I know what happened, that there is some kind of closure. But then I think one of the things that you do, and I have a question about this, but at the end, is kind of yank that carpet back from under our feet a little bit by suggesting, well, maybe we don't know what happened, because the conceit, I think one of the conceits that you're dealing with, right, is historians sort of coming to the conclusion that this is what happened. When, you know, at certain levels we can say yes, but at certain levels we have to say we have no idea. which gets back to, and this is the what I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about for us, this idea of fiction being more true than reality or than the truth. And I think Charlotte Delbo said something like this similar, you know, that I don't know if what I wrote is true, but it is the truth. Can you talk a little about this idea of an invented reality that is true, even if sort of the facts and the details aren't true?
Yeah, so this is something that I was of course very preoccupied with, and before I wrote the book too. As I said, you know, even much earlier on, when I was going to these conferences, Holocaust conferences, the people were talking about when was the final solution decided on? Was it on the 20th of January, or was it in September? And I was thinking, yeah, that's intellectually an interesting question, but the truth of the event is it may lie elsewhere. It's not like a decision on when do we switch from gas-driven cars to electric cars. It's something else. There's something. And so I was always interested in that. But here, I'd say when I was writing the fictional documents from which much of this book is made, it was not difficult for me to write them, because I had seen so many such documents. I had seen testimonies, I'd seen like historians working on this topic. We are inundated with these documents. And so the sound of what it would sound like, how a Pole from that part of the world who had been deported to the Soviet Union and then ends up in Palestine, how he would write, I knew what the voice would be. And I just had to change it a little bit to fit the story that I was writing. So in that sense, the invention of the document and the context within which this happens was there for me. I didn't have to invent much. But what was missing was those specific people. Those people that don't exist, but they did exist, or some of them existed. I know that some of them existed. I know that I had a great uncle who played the violin. Why did he play the violin? Because in World War I, he was a refugee in Prague, and there, what did he do? He studied the violin, and then he used to play the violin at family gatherings. And we know that he died. We know he was murdered. How? We don't know. Where? We're not sure. So the truth of that person, the truth of that case didn't exist. But it happened. It's not that it didn't happen. It just couldn't be expressed. And so, in a sense, I was, taking on myself a kind of role of giving people their true life, but the life that nobody told, that nobody remembered. There were people who saw how this man died, but they were not there anymore to report it. And someone had to do it. Now, I didn't feel that I was, you know, engaged in telling us something that we don't know in general. We know the general outline. We know what happened, but we don't know the details. We don't know the people themselves. And now at the same time, when we do know, we also know that our knowledge comes from a report, a confession, a letter, a memory, a rumor. And it's all that is. It's not the full truth, if there is one. And even if there were an event that we know happened precisely as it did, we know about it from different people who saw it from different angles, from different perspectives, or who heard about it from different people. And so the event itself is a sort of conglomeration of all those perspectives. And it could have been seen and understood as it is in this case, very differently by different people. And even the same people who tell you the story might have told that story or remembered that story very differently at a different time. And when they tell it, as say, the grandfather ultimately confesses, he is confessing to his grandson. He has a stake in that confession. He wants his grandson to love him. He wants to be remembered well. So can we believe what he tells us, even if it sounds like the most horrifying confession there would be? And can we sympathize or empathize with this man? Because at this point, as an old man, he is trying to tell a story that he had never told. So all of this presents a kind of truth that we want to tell as historians in a very different light. That A, history cannot tell us a lot of what happened in the past, and B, the claim of history that at least what it does tell is truthful, more or less, on the lower level. When you get back to where history actually happens, you can never tell. You can only say there are different versions of it. From the top, we know what happened, but if we were in there, we would have experienced it differently from our neighbor, from our brother, from our parents, because we are who we are and we'd see it with our own eyes.
Yeah, that's one of the things that struck me, because I think oftentimes there's an assumption that an eyewitness testimony is better than another kind. And I think one of the things that the characters in the book show is that, as you say, I mean, we are always only left with a story, whether it's a voluntary story told, you know, orally in passing, or a story told in interrogation, or a story told in a sort of deathbed confession. But unless we were literally there to see it with our own eyes, and even then the motivations behind the actual physical act are still going to be something we're never going to know.
Go ahead. There's just one other thing that I'm thinking about, that there is another kind of truth, and that interests me, and that I'm still very interested in now. So there's the truth of what happened and what is told, and how can we put together something that we didn't know about. But there's another truth. That when you speak with a person, when you listen to a person telling their story, what happens is not just that you may find out events that you didn't know about or get a different version of those events. Something happens between you and that person. And that kind of empathy that can be created when you're listening to a person speak, especially if they speak about their own lives, they speak about what happened to them, they speak in cases that we are talking about, often about traumatic events or about the loss of people. Something happens between you and that person that gives you insight that you cannot gain from a document. And that insight can't quite be put on a page, but it opens you up to a different kind of understanding of that person and of the event that that person is telling you about. And that, if it doesn't happen, that's partly what in the book, the people who underwent such events didn't talk, didn't tell them, or if they told them, they falsified them. And as long as that is not spoken about or is lied about or is repressed, then it builds a kind of untruth from one generation to the next. And that untruth is not only about what happened, it's internal to you. You live with some kind of emptiness, with a void, with a vague sense that something is not known or has been lied about. And to overcome that is to open up yourself to yourself. It's to, if you like, to put it in sort of romantic terms, is to make it possible for you to love, because you can't as long as you're clamped in, as long as something is based on a lie, your entire life, without knowing what it is, you feel there's some falsehood deep inside. So in a sense, in this book, I'm also interested in that, in the opening up. And that's why the narrator doesn't accomplish it. Tali and Andri, the two characters, in a sense do, but the narrator is left on his own. He does not seem to actually be able to open up.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely seems, you can still see the distance that in some ways the narrator ends up being, as I said at the beginning, sort of the vehicle, but not the one that sort of has a narrative right. arc of the beginning, a middle, and an end piece. And one of the things that actually caused me to think back to some of the characters in the book, because there's lots of other characters about in this small town in, you know, what is now Ukraine. But one of them that was really striking to me, and I don't know if it's in all of your other interviews we've done with people about this book or hearing feedback, but it was the Jewish policeman. I felt like you mentioned empathy, and for whatever reason, I really felt a lot of empathy for his story, which is, I guess it was kind of unexpected, because at least the way he paints himself as other people paint him, you know, other people paint him as a very sort of despicable character. You know, and we always say as historians, well, you know, it's complex and people did things for complex motivations and may have volunteered to be a Jewish policeman in the ghetto for various reasons. But I think I was really struck by the way that the way you portrayed it with this person, it gave me an emotional reaction that I wasn't expecting. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little about that example, or how you got to it, or why you included it? Because it doesn't occupy a great deal of the book, but I think it's actually a really important character.
You know, so many of the characters there invented or half invented or based on all kind of fragments. In my book, Tales from the Borderlands, in the last three chapters, it's a sort of extended conversation with my mother. And one of the characters that she mentions is someone who showed up after the war. They were living in Palestine, and this relative, a cousin of her father, of my grandfather, shows up. And he's still a relatively young man. He's handsome. And my grandfather, who was a sort of simple and very kind, large man, working man, who was always kind to everyone, does not want to have anything to do with this relative, who is the only survivor. And eventually he disappears, and there's rumors what happened to him. And that's all I knew. And my father, who heard the story and I asked him about it, said, oh, well, he was a couple. And I asked him, how do you know he was a couple? He says, you know how I know? Because he made some money and he donated it all to some survivors association. And I said, I mean, how does that make him a couple? Maybe he just felt sorry for those people. He said, no, we all knew. So I thought, what is the story of this man? And his miserable end, I mean, there were various, either he committed suicide or he went to South America, or, you know, there were all these rumors, but he vanished. And so I thought about it, and because I know, and I interviewed when I was working on Anatomy of a Genocide, a number of people who were policemen. Not all of whom admitted to me that they were policemen. I found that from documentation, not from the interview. The interview was about other very interesting things, but they didn't admit that. I thought this story needs some airing. I need to think this through. And as I started writing, he leaves this note, right? The narrator finds out about him in a memorial book for the town from which this man came, or where he lived when the Germans arrived. And as I started writing it, I think maybe like you, I started understanding what was happening with this man, how you stumble into something for a variety of reasons that some of them have to do with survival. Some of them have to do with just, you know, if you're a policeman, you have a better chance of surviving. Some of them have to do with wanting to help family members, because as long as you're a policeman, you can help them. Some of them have to do with completely different things, with your past, right? With how you were treated before. But somehow, how that leads you into a particular situation, and how if you see it through his eyes, through his story, which may or may not be true, because he leaves this to the narrator's grandfather, it may not be true at all, or it may be partly true. But that's the way he wants to tell that story. And when you read that story, there's a truth in that story that you cannot dismiss the way, say, my father did and said, oh, well, he was a couple. No, he was a man. He was a man who found himself in a terrifying situation, who survived it somehow, who then went off to be a heroic soldier. And then when he came to Palestine and to Israel, somebody found out who he was, and he could never take it back. And he somehow had to disappear from people's lives. Maybe he went to make a lot of money in Australia or Argentina. We don't know, but he vanished from that story. He no longer exists in that story. So for me, I think it was important, and I wasn't thinking about it so clearly when I was writing, but when we think about Mikhailo, about the Ukrainian grandfather, who also ends up being involved in killing, our sort of simple way of thinking about, even as historians, and we're supposed to be smarter as historians, but we often fall into these categories, right? Our simple way of thinking is, okay, there were people who collaborated, there were Ukrainians who collaborated, there were Jews who collaborated, there were people who were victims, there were people who were perpetrators. And we don't get too deeply into the story of those people themselves. We've already categorized them. And if we tell that story the way they would tell it, and they often don't, they often no one asks them, and they don't leave these documents behind. But if we were to let them tell it, it's not like it would take them off the hook. What they did is what they did. But we'd understand something through precisely that kind of empathy that you can arrive at only by listening to another person, not telling them, not judging them. You may judge them later on, but when you listen to them, you hear something, and that will eventually tell you some things also about yourself, at least about the potential in yourself.
Yeah, I that's a really good way of putting it, because I'm thinking now about how I read sources, and yeah, I mean, as historians, sometimes we're very sort of mathematical, in the sense of like the for and against column of like, do I believe this? Is this likely? Is this likely? And obviously, you know, with certain categories of people in the context of the Holocaust, you have sort of some pre-existing emotions about whether you should like them or empathize with them, or even whether you should try to imagine their feelings. And I think that this is a good example of that, and of also the idea that, which we'll come back to in a second, I guess, but that ultimately, when you're dealing with these ego documents, like you are in the, that you've created, at some level, it eventually comes back to, do you believe them or not? Right? I mean, like, because we, as you sort of were suggesting, that there's a, something you can't really put on paper, you know, that, well, I just believe that I think he's telling the truth, you know, or I think this right. is truthful, but you know, it would look silly in words if you wrote that.
Yeah. And there's a difference between Between the truth, is this person telling the truth, or is this person being truthful? It's not the same thing. And you may find out that what they told you, and often this will be the case, certainly people who are involved in crimes and misdemeanors, that they're not telling you the whole truth. And they're not telling you everything but nothing but the truth. But if you can get to a point at which they're truthful, at which, and it may not be everything they tell you, but there's a moment at which they're being truthful, they are speaking from their heart, then you will understand something, that maybe the casing is not the full story or the correct story. But when you get there, you may understand something that a completely truthful story or a completely true story would lack. That you would read some document that gives you, you know, when it happened, how it happened, who did it, and yet it there would be no understanding there. There would be no humanity in it. There would be no contact between you that. And of course, the Holocaust is full of those documents. Documents that you read and you're horrified by what you're reading and the way it's put on the page in this kind of dry bureaucratic manner. But you, there's no understanding in it. The person writing it has no understanding of what happened. They know the facts, but they have no understanding of it. And you cannot gain any understanding by looking at those figures and those dates. You can just put them on the page. You can reorganize them. You can reshuffle it. But you end up as with this sort of state of unbelief that you had before. And so, yeah, that's what I think, you know, in some ways I started thinking about it many, many years ago when I was studying the German army, when I was a graduate student in the early 1980s. And I used to say that I have several hundred frozen Wehrmacht officers in my closet because I had all these personal documents. And I said to myself, I cannot sympathize with these people, but I have to empathize with them. I have to think through their experience, through their eyes. Otherwise, I won't understand anything of what they did and why they did it. And they were real, of course. But it is this mechanism of listening to a person tell their own story.
And I think one of the things that because obviously, you know, as a Holocaust historian myself, I'm reflecting constantly, you know, back on my own work and what I'm looking at and what I'm now seeing in some ways as sort of the tyranny of the legal document, where, for example, you know, I finished this book on the Janowska camp, and you know, a survivor will be giving a very detailed discussion of all of the bad things that happened and all of the people that were doing them, you know, which in some ways is very useful and in some ways is very truthful in the way that you've just indicated. And then they'll say something like, and then in June 1943, I escaped, and then go on to talk about something else, where, you know, to me, that deserves a lot more mention, right? But in some ways, they're constrained by the structure of the document, where the prosecutor don't care how you escaped. That's not really relevant to what they're looking at. Right. Whereas when you were writing this book, you could construct each document in a way that would be natural for them to tell us more of sort of their thoughts and feelings, you know, behind the scenes. And then you're not constrained by all the limitations of the format, which I guess leads me to ask the question, you know, how is writing this book different than writing a history book? For our listeners, you know, Omer's books are not dry academies either. So, I mean, they're interesting narrative, you know, engaging works. But how is writing this different than writing sort of a scholarly book? With the exception of the fact that you get to make up the documents.
Yeah. First of all, I'll say there is one real document in the book, and I don't say which one it is. And someone who read the book said that she loved the book and all that. But there's one document there that she thought didn't quite work. And that's the one.
That's the real one.
So, yeah. Look, it was a very different experience for me. It's not the first work of fiction I've written. I actually wrote two others in the 1980s, but I wrote them in Hebrew and they came out in Israel, two short novels. But this one was a particularly, in some ways, it was a very exciting experience for me, I must say. I really wanted to write the book, and I was telling my wife, who is a professor of literature, I was saying, listen, I really want to write the book. The semester will come to an end. I'll take the weekend off and then I'll start writing. And she said to me, why take the weekend off? Just start writing. So I said, okay. And I got up the next morning at 4 a.m. and I started writing. And I wrote for 3 weeks every day from 4 to noon, more or less. And in the afternoons, I sort of would take walks and think about it a bit and then sleep on it. And the next day I would just sit down and write. And I had no moments where I just had to stop and think, so what happens now? It was as if everything had been waiting to be written, and yet I knew only the rough contours of it. And I became entirely absorbed in the story, and I moved from character to character. And so the first draft was written in 3 weeks. In a kind of, I wouldn't say obsessive state, but complete immersion in this. And then I took a few days off. We went off to Maine and we're talking about it. And then when I came back, I wrote an extended version of it, in a few more weeks, took another month or so. But that has to do with the fact that this story, as I sort of allude to at the end, was written in some sort of early form already in the 1980s. But in the 1980s, I knew nothing about that place. And I imagined it. And there are actually all kind of, especially American novels, that sort of so-called magical realism, where people imagine those places.
But they don't really know.
But they don't know.
The history, the historical context for it.
They know nothing. So they imagine them, but they don't know. They've not even traveled there. And so when I get back to that, in a sense, I knew what I knew and I knew what I didn't know. And that was the gap. And that was the gap where I had to tell the story. But I could tell it within a world that, whether it's in the book or not, it was in my mind. I knew it. I could feel it. I'd walked in it. So I think it had been waiting to be written, in a sense. So it was, in some ways, I mean, it has difficult moments, of course, but the act of writing it was enjoyable. Yeah.
Do you think that writing this book has helped you to sort through some of your own family's history, in the sense that, you know, that you're sort of showing characters in the book doing this, but obviously this is a very personal journey for you to write this book. I mean, do you feel closure is the wrong word, because obviously one cannot have closure for one's, you know, bulk of their family being killed. But has this given you some, I guess, positive place to move forward from, if that makes sense, or was that for the reader to sort of experience?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, in a sense, a part of me is like the narrator. And I've always had to balance between not just what I was taught as a student at Oxford, that you have to have detachment from your, but, you know, from your historical subject, but psychologically, I think I always maintain a certain distance. And I was not a very great family person. I mean, I had a large family in Israel, but most of my large family in Israel were very distant relatives. And in Israel, you sort of had those as your family because your closer relatives were all murdered. So you sort of had these other, but I was not that close to my family, my parents, of course, but not, and one uncle, but not much beyond that. So I think what the book did for me was not so much to resolve issues of the family, but to resolve issues for myself. And to do that thing that I talked about earlier that happens to Tali and Andri, a certain opening that the narrator misses, but that I think writing the book helped me do. And it was part of a process. And it was interesting for me because, you know, about less than a year. So the book came out in January 2023. And in October 2023, I went to Israel and spent 3 months there and was interviewing people of my generation. And many of them grew up in, both Jews and Palestinians grew up in traumatized families, families that had experienced genocide, displacement, a great deal of suffering. They were born right after it, but it was all around them. And I think that having written that book created something for me, some opening in me. And I'll say one last thing that was very interesting for me that has to do with that. In last June, so June 2023, I was in Israel, and the Hebrew version of this book came out. I wrote it again in Hebrew. I didn't have it translated. And it was important for me to have it also in Hebrew. English was one language that nobody spoke in the world that the book is about. Hebrew, right, yeah. Yes, but English, no one spoke English there. So, but it was very important for me to have it also in Hebrew. And to launch the book, there was some event in a bookstore, and about 50 people came, and all the 50 people who came were friends of mine, some of whom I hadn't seen for 50 years, 40 years, 30 years, and some of whom I were regular friends that I see whenever I come to Israel. And something was created there around this book that was extraordinarily moving for me. And I'm not someone who sort of gets very sentimental. So I think, and they read the book, and so I think it did something on a personal, interpersonal level rather than a familial one.
Well, I mean, I think it definitely comes through. I mean, obviously I'm not, the one question I'm not going to ask you is the, how much of the book is, you know, lifted from your experience or your personal life, but I can certainly, there's certainly the feeling. Right, that there are moments where you are really, where the narrator is you, or Tali's reminiscences are reminiscences of your family and that kind of thing, which is something I think is really nice because it breaks down a different historical barrier, which is the, you know, the historian as aloof observer with no sort of emotional connection to his or her sort of topic, and at the risk of sort of a not too subtle segue, but you did mention sort of going back to Israel, interviewing Palestinians and Israelis. And obviously, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask about at the end of this episode is the modern context of being a Holocaust historian, in your case, being an Israeli-American Holocaust historian, in the context of the war in Israel between the Palestinians and Israelis, because I it's not in the sense of trying to, because I've seen you on various news outlets talking about this, but I think it'd be really interesting to get your sense of what is it like to be someone who is straddling all of these different areas in a moment where the Holocaust seems like it's the sort of the third character in the Israel-Palestine conflict, because it's being used by, it's being brought up by all sides as sort of a stick to beat the other one with, in my estimation, in some ways. How do you see the Holocaust being used or being, you know, I guess, reflected by the actors in this moment that we're in?
Yeah, reflected and invoked and and used and sometimes weaponized. And look, I mean, it's first of all, just observing everything that is going on is heartbreaking. As I said, you know, I go to Israel a lot. My best friends are in Israel. I have family in Israel. Some of my family was directly affected by what happened on October 7th. And then I see that what is going on in Gaza and how the Israeli public refuses to watch it. It's actually not shown on TV, and any empathy for Palestinians in Gaza is just missing from the Israeli discourse. It's so the whole thing is extraordinary. And then the Holocaust being invoked by everyone. Yes. The Germans invoked the Holocaust so as to be on the side of Israel. And the Israelis invoked the Holocaust and say, this is the greatest killing of the Jews since the Holocaust. And pro-Palestinians say how, which has been said many times before, how can Israel do to the Palestinians what the Germans did to the Jews, and how they are now those committing genocide, and you know, on Israeli TV, Hamas are called Nazis. That's how they come up, Hamas Nazis. They used to say ISIS or Daesh, but now they just say Hamas Nazis. So it triggers all these things. So what do I think? I mean, the first thing I think is that one should avoid such analogies to the extent that one can. These analogies are not good analogies, and if you can avoid invoking the Holocaust, please do so. But nobody is listening, of course. For one reason, because the Nazis always win out. I mean, if you compare the Nazis to anybody, they are always worse. And so it's not a good comparison, it's not a good analogy, and it's used by everyone not to explain anything, but to obfuscate, to confuse, to incite. That's why it's used. And one would hope that it wasn't used, but of course it is all the time. The Holocaust, since the 1980s, more or less, has become increasingly used in Israeli politics, mostly in the context of the conflict with the Palestinians. So it's always used to justify what is otherwise very hard to justify. It usually comes with invocations of anti-Semitism. So any criticism of policies of what the state does is presented as anti-Semitism, which is intended to shut people up, to stop criticism. So when I see that, it's very hard for me. And one result is that my sort of what I've been saying since October 7th has been quite hard for many of my Israeli friends. And I don't have friends on the extreme right in Israel, or even on the, you know, very much on the right at all. So most of my friends are people who tend to be sort of liberal left. And some of them say to me, look, but you don't feel what we feel. We agree with what you're saying, but you're not expressing enough empathy with our pain. And possibly if I were there, I would speak differently. And if I spoke the way I speak, I would also be extremely unpopular. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is that the fact that I've written on the Holocaust, that I've written on genocide, that I've written on war, that I live in America, and that I'm an Israeli, has, I think, given me a kind of perspective that, and certain sets of knowledge that many people speaking about these events don't have. And it's given me a certain confidence to say, and I try to be very balanced within my own mind and as judicious as I can, but has given me an opportunity to speak and to try and understand what is going on and to point it out. And I've come to believe that it's necessary to do that, and that many people like us who sort of, you know European history, know about the Holocaust and all that, other people who are experts in the Middle East, don't talk. They don't talk because they're afraid either that they would be said to be anti-Semitic or whatever if they criticize Israel, or they would be presented as colonialists, as settler colonialists, supporters of imperialism if they are critical of Hamas. And because many people don't speak, they leave the space open for the extremists on both sides. And they help polarization by trying to avoid it, by just sticking to their own stuff. They just write another article and try not to watch the news. And I feel like we should talk. It's our role, and we have some knowledge, we have some understanding. We shouldn't make facile analogies, but we have learned something from history, and we should apply it. And we shouldn't keep quiet.
I wonder, at the risk, I hope this isn't a facile analogy, but it's one that has sort of come into my thinking just based on our conversation, and it's one that I haven't heard made, and possibly because it's incredibly complex. But maybe you're in a good position, particularly with your recent, with your new book project as well. Is there somewhat of an analogy or something to be learned from, say, interwar relationships between Poles, Jews, Ukrainians, and, you know, people living together in close proximity who have differing viewpoints on some things, but ultimately quite often get along quite fine, and Palestinians and Israeli Jews in this context? I mean, is...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, there is. There is. And instead of making these sort of analogies between what Israel is doing in Gaza, what Hamas did in Israel directly to the Nazis, which is not a very useful analogy, you can make an analogy between, say, what happened in Buchach, in this town that I wrote on, where Jews, Poles, and Ukrainians lived side by side. They had their own socioeconomic niches. They had different religions. They had resentments and so forth. But at the same time, they lived together, and it was not a violent place. They often spoke a little bit of each other's languages. They interacted with each other. They lived their life. And in some ways, it was a rich life. And in some ways, this sort of mix of different traditions, different religions, different ethnicities actually was creative, precisely because people were not only in this one culture, one tradition. And then they started killing each other. And why? So what is it that makes an inter-ethnic community at some point, after 400 years of living side by side, go at each other's throats? And so one thing that is clear in that case is ethno-nationalism. And ethno-nationalism started telling people, hey, you know, your neighbor doesn't actually belong here. They came here long after you did. They came 400 years ago, and your ancestors came 1,000 years ago. And therefore, why are they here? They are just colonizing you, or they're exploiting you. They don't belong here. And once you begin this kind of discourse and you argue, this place belongs to me and not to them, and therefore they have no business being here, you are already creating a situation where this naturalness of all of us being here because we've always been here becomes unnatural. Mm-hmm. Then you need the trigger. And the trigger could be a war, and especially it could be if some group comes in that really has genocidal intentions. If not genocidal, then ethnic cleansing intentions. And then it mobilizes those sentiments that take decades to grow and uses them. And that's exactly what's happening in Israel-Palestine. You have people who would live together. In fact, people whose culture is very close to each other. If you just sit and talk one-on-one, they eat the same food, they have the same gestures, their languages got mixed up together. They're very close. But first of all came this nationalist discourse that says, you don't belong. I came first. It's my land, it's my land. And then you have groups created such as Hamas on the one side, which is a very extreme group that wants to basically create an Islamic state in Palestine, Islamic Palestinian state, where Jews would not have any room. And the national religious, these people like a couple of ministers in the Israeli cabinet, who have exactly the same goal. They want to create a halachic state, that is a Jewish religious state, from the Jordan to the sea, for Jews. Also not for gays or for liberated women or anything. It would be, you know, a sort of Iran-style state. And they are Jewish supremacists. And now these two groups are mirror images of each other. They don't represent a majority, but they thrive on something that has already been created there. That thing of it's either mine or yours. It's either me or you. So yes, you can learn a great deal from it, and you can see where this is heading unless you stop it, unless you start working in the opposite direction. You can, but nobody is doing it right now.
Yeah, it's a lot to think about. And it's, I guess that one of the positive things is that at least you can see a way that the history of the period that we study, if you are astute enough to pick the right parts of it, can perhaps help us, you know, to learn something, rather than just, you know. And it's interesting because some of the discourse that I'm seeing, particularly in the UK from certain journalists, is that, you know, you said that nobody can be worse than the Nazis. They sort of doubled down on it and said that Hamas is actually worse than the Nazis, you know, which is sort of the ultimate, well, then I can't. Then we can have no conversation left, if that's the case. So we've taken up a lot of your time. I don't want to take up too much more. But I do want to ask the one question that we sort of ask at the end of the podcast, which is, if you could recommend to listeners one book on the Holocaust, that for whatever, and you can sort of explain why. It doesn't have to be the book that will, if you only read one book, because obviously there's way too much to cover. It can sort of be, you know, your favorite band at the moment. But what would you recommend as one book about the Holocaust or regarding the Holocaust that you would recommend for us to read?
Yeah, it's such a hard question, you know, because it also depends what you are looking for. in a book on the Holocaust. I think as a book of history that is written well, and you know that I appreciate people also write well and tells a complex story and a rich story, but reads well. Probably Saul Friedlander's The Nazi Extermination of the Jews, the two volumes.
The two volumes, it.
Yeah, I think that now that's a lot of reading, but I think so. I would say that sometimes I mean my sense is that sometimes you can learn about an event not through a direct telling it. Now that's not that you shouldn't read history. I'm very much in favor of reading history. And I think people don't read enough history. And that's part of the problem these days. But I would say something that tells you what is the cost of all this? What is the cost of destruction of humans, of civilization? I would recommend a book that I alluded to earlier by Sebald, Sebald,
mm-hmm.
Austerlitz, which is in some ways, it's a book of fiction. And it's related in various ways to Saul Friedlander himself, who came from Prague and who had to recreate his identity as a child who lost his parents. But it's a beautiful book, and it's a book that really tells you about the ruins of memory, the ruins of identity, the fragmentation of an entire world as a result of genocide. And as we said right at the beginning, that's really the most fundamental truth about what the Holocaust and what any genocide is about. It's making something disappear entirely. And how do you put it together again? And so that's a beautiful book, and I would recommend it too.
Well, I think that those are two great recommendations, and that sort of, it's a great tie-in to the book we started with, which is yours, which is that there are different kinds of truths, you know, that we can get from reading. You know, we can, and Friedlander, I think, does a good job of actually mixing these more than most, but, you know, we can read a very meticulously researched and argued history of the Holocaust, and that teaches us something. We learn something. We can also read, you know, a fictional book or literature or Friedlander, where he is very much, I think, attempting to bring human stories and that kind of stuff into it. Right. And we get a different truth. So those are really great, I think, recommendations. Omer, as we close, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to chat with us today and tell us about this book. I really, really appreciate it. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
And for those of you that are listeners, welcome. Please like, subscribe, share if you enjoyed the podcast with everyone that you can. And we will see you next time.